DW, Living Planet, with Jordan Wilden.
We have one of the most biodiverse countries in the world. We're losing it very fast also right now due to deforestation. And so being able to work hands-on with communities is something that I'm really thankful for.
Rainforests are being destroyed all around the world to support our lifestyle. How can we compensate? And how do we tackle the ever-growing mountain of waste which comes with our consumer society?
You have a lot of waste produced through these non-refillable pots that are usually they just last for a day or two and then you have to throw them away.
We'll be thinking about these issues and more here on DW's Living Planet. I'm Jordan Wilden. It's no secret that much of our waste ends up in landfill. In Paris, a combination of factors, including building contractors trying to save cash, has caused illegal landfills to appear all over France's capital. Marion Lefebvre investigates.
The path looked just right for a country stroll, all green and somehow remote from the nearest houses. But a couple hundred meters away from a quiet street of Carrière-sous-Boissy, a suburban town some 40 kilometers west of Paris, lies the biggest illegal landfill in France.
On a absolutely de tout, comme type de déchets. On a des déchets du bâtiment, et notamment avec de l'amiante.
We have everything here, every type of waste. We have construction waste and asbestos, also bathtubs, wood, rubble, absolutely everything. From what I counted, there is approximately 7,000 to 8,000 tons of waste on 47 hectares in total.
Since the early 2000s, locals have been battling with illegal waste piling up between 7 and 38 tons. The area was previously used to grow food before lead contamination ended it. Alban Bernard lives next to the wasteland.
We were walking around with my dog and I came nose to nose with an ocean of waste just in front of me. And then I was disgusted. I don't even have words today to tell you how I feel about this. It horrifies me. It makes my hair stand on end. It disgusts me and I'm furious to see so much waste everywhere. I'll say it how I feel it. I think France is disgusting.
J'ai l'impression qu'aujourd'hui, je vais le dire comme je le ressens, je pense que la France est dégueulasse.
Mr. Bernard has been roaming what he calls la plaine, or the field, for more than a year now. He decided to make a map to highlight where dangerous waste lies.
Il y a de la laine de verre, il y a de l'amiante.
Fiberglass, asbestos, all sorts of dangerous products, cleaning and painting products too. And those dangerous products are going to end up in our glasses, and then we will drink the water from them.
Dans nos verres, et on boira l'eau après. Ah ben voilà, tiens. Extrêmement inflammable, irritant.
Here we go. Extremely flammable, irritating and dangerous for the environment. It's written on the label. Of course, everything we had in this has gone in the earth, and it's going down into the groundwater.
Trucks cannot drop their loads in a field anymore. A town hall decree now strictly forbids it. Today the situation is stuck, partly because many private entities own small parts of the field and gave up trying to get rid of the waste. It was constantly brought in by both companies and people living on those lands, according to the authorities. But this case of illegal wasteland is far from unique. France has only recently started to focus on the problem through its first ever study conducted by the national agency in charge of environmental matters. Christophe Marquet is an engineer there.
L'ensemble du territoire national, y compris les territoires.
The entire country, including overseas, is concerned by this topic. The study clearly shows that the issue of illegal landfills is a long-lasting problem. It's worsening, so we have to be vigilant.
Constante, voire en voie d'aggravation, donc il faut de toute façon toujours rester vigilant.
The Paris region has devoted so far 5.4 million euros to the issue, but local, regional and national levels of government overlap, making the process highly unproductive.
We're in a very complex country. It becomes incomprehensible for people.
Jean-Philippe Dugoin-Clément, the region's vice president.
And yes, in Carrière-sous-Poissy, you pile up different administrative layers that have overlapping competences. And when everyone is responsible, no one is really.
In Carrière-sous-Poissy, Alban Bernard blames the construction industry for the damage done.
It's mostly construction, and I ask everyone working in construction to come see what's happening in the sea of waste and tell me if it's not construction waste. We're going to see, because this, all of this, is construction waste. Don't tell me otherwise.
Local entrepreneurs are often blamed, but Jean-Jacques Chatelain, who's in charge of the waste problem in the National Confederation for Small Construction Companies, puts the blame elsewhere.
J'ai découvert qu'il y avait des circuits parallèles qui existaient.
I discovered parallel systems where a company like mine can find a telephone number and an address. It's a bit like Uber, half the usual price. But studies revealed they throw the waste wherever they please, and they could be, we have to be careful, part of the people who do not manage their waste well. When you've called them to make it right, maybe that's where we should be more careful on our part.
The situation only worsens because recycling centers open to construction waste and to toxic waste, especially in rural areas, are hard to access. Issues include
the cost you cannot put on the invoice, how recycling centers are scattered around me, how close they are, and also the different places according to the products they take in. If we're talking about asbestos, for instance, you cannot do what you want with that.
So, Carrière sous Poissy is only the tip of the iceberg. France is below the European average when it comes to recycling waste. 42% against 66% in Germany, for instance.
Ça fait partie des sujets pour le coup où nous nous souhaitons dans le cadre du plan régional.
It's one of the issues for which we're trying to push for more coordination in the regional plan for waste, for instance. But I think personally that we have to be stringent on illegal landfills, that we need to strengthen sanctions because today the risk is still relatively low for them.
Relativement faible.
The Ministry of Environment is currently working on the issue of illegal wastelands and should include it in a larger environmental law in the upcoming month. In the meantime, in France's largest illegal dump...
What's not here is being abandoned elsewhere. I'm currently mapping illegal landfills in France, and I can tell you there are more and more every day. When you click on See the Map, you see absolutely all illegal landfills in France. We're almost up to 100 as of today.
From time to time, the city hall tries to clean small parts of the land with local volunteers. But Alban Bernard fears that inhabitants may still have to wait for a long time before the area is permanently cleaned up and safe again to walk around. Marion Lefebvre, DW, Paris.
In Colombia, a gas firm is building a pipeline through a threatened ecosystem, but is paying to protect plants and animals elsewhere. Is this compensation model a responsible way to protect nature? Christian Roman went to Colombia to find out. His report is presented by Irene Quayle.
Jorge Maziri, wearing a white helmet and protective glasses, is walking proudly through a processing plant on Colombia's Caribbean coast. The blazing Caribbean sun is reflecting on the gas pipes. He kneels down to check them.
One of our objectives as a corporation is to connect the whole of Colombia up to the power grid. We are therefore ensuring that energy sources, in this case natural gas, can be supplied to energy facilities throughout the country.
Maziri works for Promigas, which operates the processing plant. The company puts out nearly 7 million cubic meters of natural gas per day. It's the country's second largest supplier. And they're determined to build even more pipelines. That's why, in 2015, Promigas hacked a corridor through the tropical rainforest here, 25 metres wide and 192 kilometres long, cutting down thousands of trees and devastating natural habitats in the process. The United Nations Development Programme negotiated a deal with the gas provider. Promigas was to compensate for the environmental damage by funding new projects aimed at protecting biodiversity and ecosystems elsewhere in the country. But is this compensation model a sensible way to protect nature? John Bejarano, who negotiated the deal for the UN's Biodiversity Finance Initiative, thinks it is.
Compensation is a good instrument. Even if it turns out to be the very last option, if we can no longer avoid reduce or mitigate environmental damage. It can be part of the solution in a developing country like Colombia, where the infrastructure is growing continuously, with new roads, new electricity grids, new gas pipelines, new dams and new ports going up that all impact on biodiversity. The country still has 50% of its native forests, but a high proportion of its population also lives in poverty.
Expanding infrastructure in Colombia has already had a major impact on the environment. Tropical rainforests harboring unique ecosystems once stretched over 40% of the country. Now they cover just 4%. The tiny Los Colorados Wildlife Sanctuary, for instance, is home to 2,500 plant species, many of them endemic. But the conservation area is just 1,000 hectares in size, and it's shrinking all the time. Crystal Anghi from the Caribbean Environmental Heritage Foundation is working to change that, with the compensation money provided by Promigas.
We have one of the most biodiverse countries in the world. We're losing it very fast also right now due to deforestation. And so being able to work hands-on with communities is something that I'm really thankful for.
One of the communities benefiting from the compensation is San Juan de Nepo Museno. Crystal Anghi and her NGO work together with the farmers here. For years, their lives and livelihoods were disrupted by armed conflict between right-wing paramilitaries and left-wing insurgent groups. Now, the peace process in Colombia has allowed farmers to return. The idea is for the farmers to live and work in a more sustainable fashion and minimize environmental damage from deforestation, farming, and livestock breeding.
We've been working with the national park system, we've been working with other NGOs, but we haven't worked with the private sector. And it's something new for everyone, not just for us, but for the community as well. We've been having very deep discussions with the community as far as how much should we compensate, what is compensation, and how do those resources from the private sector end up in the hands of the community.
The money doesn't go directly to the farmers. Instead, they're provided with working clothes and tools and invited to take part in workshops. Instead of monocultures, they now plant native varieties of fruit and vegetables such as yams, which they sell in the capital. Farmers like Julian Leiva now see the importance of the environment for their own livelihoods.
It's important to have these forested areas because they provide us with water, medicinal plants, and oxygen. The entire ecosystem has a direct impact on our standard of living, our health, and the physical development of people here.
For John Bejarano, the compensation scheme is just the beginning.
Every single year in Colombia, we lose forests covering an area the size of our capital, Bogotá. Compensation helps companies think about the impact their actions have on the natural environment and makes them realize that they have a responsibility. At the same time, local communities are assuming more obligations. It's not just about receiving donations. It's about greater awareness of both their rights and their responsibilities towards the environment.
If Colombia's precious rainforests are to be preserved, Bejarano is convinced everyone here will have to do their bit.
Irene Quayle presented that report, which was filed by Christian Roman. clearing land to produce beef, soy, and palm oil, which is used in so many of our everyday foods, has long been known to accelerate deforestation in countries such as Brazil and Indonesia. Now, a group of international scientists have researched how deforestation is linked to international trade, and how part of that is our responsibility. My colleague Ajit Niranjan joins me in the studio now. Ajit, does this mean that it's not just the producer who is responsible for the damage caused by deforestation?
Exactly. It means if you, say in Indonesia, a forest is raised to make a palm oil producing plantation, and some of that palm oil is sent through complex global supply chains, ends up in a pack of cookies that you buy in a supermarket here, then basically the CO2 emissions kind of embodied in that cookie aren't really counted by the country it's landed in. Instead, they're a tribute to the country that they were produced in. And this is kind of a problem because it means that a lot of countries who don't really feel much responsibility towards these things are actually driving some of the deforestation.
Sure. So that must mean something like cattle that's raised in Brazil, surely?
Exactly. So Brazilian beef is one of the biggest causes of deforestation-related CO2 emissions. And in Brazil, I mean, I haven't been there personally, but you got these massive ranches where cattle are very inefficient to raise. You need huge amounts of crops to feed them. And so what you end up with in Brazil, for example, is large swathes of rainforest being completely destroyed for croplands, plantations, pastures. And the product that comes out, the beef, if it's consumed in Brazil, then yeah, you could say that the Brazilian emissions from that beef are being consumed by the people in the country where they're produced. But if that beef is exported and then it ends up in a stake in the USA, say, then those emissions aren't really counted. And that ultimately is at the heart of why this is a sort of quite a tense topic.
The thing that I'm curious about in light of this is what the intended outcome is. So is it not necessarily a case of putting blame on other countries, but maybe assigning responsibility?
Yeah, I think we're starting to move towards that point. At the minute, I think studies like this are mainly beneficial in terms of raising awareness about the issue. But when it comes to sort of solving the problems, then it becomes a massive can of worms. So in terms of blame, one of the big questions is for the countries that are producing these things and exporting these crops, often they have huge financial benefits for doing so. And if you take a country like Indonesia, then we're talking about, I mean, one of the Indonesian scientists who I spoke to described it as really for Indonesians, it's their livelihoods. And from this European framing, it's about the deforestation. Now, obviously, to people affected on the ground, both of those things can be true at the same time. You can be benefiting some people in a community by, in essence, importing the deforestation emissions that they've created, whilst at the same time also actually helping them have a higher quality of life. One of the biggest sources of tension here is that people don't really know what they're consuming here in richer countries particularly. And that means that when they're buying products which contain other products that may have contributed to deforestation, they're very, very far away from the actual effects of the problem. And that, for example, if you're talking about palm oil in cookies, or if you're talking about beef in a burger from a fast food store, it's very difficult for you as a consumer to understand what effects your consumption has on the world. Now, that really becomes a problem when we're talking about sort of solutions to issues like deforestation, because at the minute there's no sort of regulation about labeling the CO2 impact from deforestation. So it's all very well that these scientists have recently found out, okay, hey, we can quantify how much of a problem this is within certain error bars. But that to translate into a policy level would require, for example, regulations on certification and saying, okay, we need things to be assured to have not come from deforested areas before we'll accept them as imports. Or, for instance, to have that CO2 quantified and put onto the back of a packet of peanut butter or whatever it is we're talking about. And what's interesting is one of the study authors, Martin Persson, a Swedish scientist, he said that for him it wasn't really a case of consumers actually being able to do that much, and that really it's a problem that, yeah, we can have some contribution to, but one that was really a regulatory problem. And without getting companies to change their habits and without maybe governments regulating to pressure them to change their habits, that there isn't actually all that much consumers can do here in the Western world.
What else have you learned from doing this that surprised you?
I think the two surprising things for me is firstly how much two individual countries, Brazil and Indonesia, contribute to the destruction of rainforests and the effects of deforestation on carbon dioxide emissions. And I mean, there's two main reasons for this. The first is that actually they're just massive countries and they've got huge amounts of forest. So you'd expect them to have a greater share of deforestation-related CO2 emissions. But the other thing is that they're also massive consumers of the commodities that are particularly important for this issue. So things like beef and palm oil are two incredibly carbon-intensive products, and they both have massive domestic markets. One of the things we often, or at the very least regulators and researchers in the field, are talking about is where should the blame lie, who should solve this issue. And you can see if you look at how these researchers have traced individual commodities through different countries, that yeah, Europe, North America, the Middle East to a smaller extent, we do play a role in deforestation in tropical regions, but the majority is still domestic consumption. And so I think that's a really interesting thing, because you kind of have to grapple with this idea that, okay, in Europe, yeah, we're not accounting for any of the CO2. We're not claiming it as ours. We're saying, okay, that's CO2 produced elsewhere, so it's not our problem. But on the other hand, if we're trying to solve the issue, then it kind of does fall on us to actually take some responsibility while still accepting that we're not going to be able to completely alter the whole thing. We're still only a fraction of what's going on.
Thanks to DW environment journalist Ajit Naranjan for joining me. You can read his full article on the carbon footprint of mass deforestation at dw.com/environment. Cigarette butts are the most common single-use plastic item in the world. Every year, 6 trillion cigarettes are smoked, which, you guessed it, means 6 trillion cigarette butts. Non-biodegradable and filled with toxic chemicals like arsenic, a single cigarette butt can pollute up to 1,000 litres of water. Of course, many smokers have switched to e-cigarettes in recent years. But are these new devices all that much better for the environment? Cassandra Sund went to find out.
You've probably seen them. Small, subtle devices. They might look like a fancy pen or a long USB stick. Or maybe you've smelled them when a cloud of melon or mango vapor hits your nostrils. E-cigarettes.
It's like a little flashing light.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, those little flashing lights, it's saying when... or when it's not flashing anymore, then it's ready to
use. So now?
Yeah.
Their usage is on the rise, particularly among people who were formerly conventional cigarette smokers. A recent industry report estimates the worldwide market could be worth over $44 billion by the year 2023. Katerina is an e-cigarette user. She's 34 and lives in Berlin. Though she was a smoker, she says she didn't like the smell of smoke.
I started to use IQOS e-cigarette because I don't like the smoke of smoking when it gets into your clothes and your nails and everything is like smelling of smoke, cigarette smoke. So that's why I basically started with IQOS, and then I liked the taste.
Another e-cigarette user, Tanya, said she knew she would have to make a change after 4 years of heavy smoking.
Quit smoking, I felt that I don't have the power and the will to quit. And this resistance was really big until I was really worried about my health.
Dr. Uta Mons, a cancer researcher at the German Cancer Research Center, says this switch is logical, that in general, e-cigarettes are less harmful to an individual's health than a conventional cigarette. She explains how they work.
Well, e-cigarettes usually consist of a battery and a wick and a coil, and so there's some kind of heating element and you heat up a liquid.
There are two types of e-cigarette or vaping products, open system and closed system. An open system allows a user to refill the device on their own, but a closed system does not. Instead, a pod or a tank plugs into the device. It's typically designed to be disposable. Both kinds of products are increasing in popularity. In fact, a study from Euromonitor shows that in the last 8 years, sales for closed system vapes, aka the kind with disposable pods or flavor tanks, have increased fivefold. While traditional cigarettes are still the bigger problem for the environment based on the scale of production, e-cigarettes are becoming more and more worrisome. Here's Dr. Mons again.
It's plastic waste, basically. So, of course, there's some environmental impact. Another thing that is a bit of worrisome is that, especially when you have low-quality e-cigarettes, that sometimes through corrosion processes, they emit some metals, which are also harmful.
While the potential harm from e-cigarettes may be less than the harm from conventional cigarettes, there is still a health risk. The same is true for the environmental impacts. They still pose a problem.
But now there are new systems coming up with the Juul, for example, where you have very small devices and you have pods that are not refillable. At least they are not meant to be. And that means that you have a lot of waste produced through these non-refillable pods that are usually they just last for a day or two, and then you have to throw them away.
The manufacturers of these e-cigarettes, in fact, tell users not to attempt to refill them on their own, though crafty consumers often post videos online for ways to get around this. These devices, which are steadily gaining in popularity because of their flavors and ease of use, are essentially the Keurig of the cigarette world.
Don't be fooled by how small the units are.
That's Jim Puckett. He's the executive director and founder of the Basel Action Network, an NGO based in Seattle in the United States that combats electronic and hazardous e-waste around the planet. Jim says that his organization first raised the issue of e-waste with Juul, an e-cigarette maker that's steadily gaining market share last year. But so far, Juul has not responded to the group's concerns.
They're a very odd animal, and it's not paper scrap, it's not plastic scrap. It's a mix. People are just going to throw it into their mixed garbage if they even have separation at all. And it will end up in a landfill, most likely. In North America, certainly in Europe, more likely to go into a solid waste incinerator. But again, those hazards don't magically disappear in a landfill. They stay there. They don't magically disappear if they're a metal, an incinerator. So you're putting it out into the environment one way or another.
Jim says on average, an e-cigarette stick only lasts a year or two before it needs to be replaced. And when considering how to measure a flavor pod, you can think of each pod as the equivalent of a pack of conventional cigarettes. So a user might replace that weekly or maybe even daily. The scale of this production is only expected to continue increasing.
Small problems, when they're scaled by mass consumerism, become big problems. And we're talking millions and millions of devices sold every month on the planet just so far. And if these things really take off, there's going to be more of them. And when you scale it by that volume, that many people consuming it, you have a problem.
Jim adds that because of how these products are made, recyclers aren't exactly equipped to handle them, even if they do make it into the recycling stream. I reached out to half a dozen waste firms in Berlin, where I live, to see how they would handle such a problem. Two got back to me, but declined to be interviewed for this story. They said that they currently don't have a plan for handling e-cigarettes because they are so new. One of the firms said that in the short term, these devices are likely going into the incinerator. The lithium-ion batteries used in these e-cigarettes are highly flammable. A survey by the California Product Stewardship Council found that in 2018, 65% of fires at waste facilities were caused by batteries. And one study found that only 2% of lithium-ion batteries are recycled. When reached for comment, a Juul spokeswoman responded, "We suggest following your city's local recommendations for disposing of a lithium polymer rechargeable battery." Another e-cigarette manufacturer, Imperial Brands, also suggested following local and municipal guidelines. So, what to do with these devices? Jim says he'd like to see companies like Juul and others take more responsibility and offer take-back programs with incentives. For now, if you're concerned about trying to make your e-cigarette or vaping habit more sustainable, look for open system products with easily replaceable and recyclable parts. Remember Tanya, who switched to vaping for health reasons? She also decided to find an e-cigarette that is recyclable.
Everything is recyclable. Like, first of all, it's made almost completely out of metal and glass. But it is easy to repair, or you can find the person who repairs it, or you can go to the repair cafe.
For DW, I'm Cassandra Sunt in Berlin.
That brings us to the end of this edition of Living Planet. What do you think? Drop me an email, livingplanet@dw.com, or tweet us at @dw_environment. Thank you for listening. I have been, and still am, Jordan Wilden. Until next time. I can't keep on losing you over complications. Gone too soon. Wait, we were just hanging. I can't seem to hold on to. Dang. The people that know me best, the key that I won't forget. Soon. I can't keep on losing you. I can't keep on losing you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. How many mistakes do it take till you leave? And I'm left with my hand and my face all red, and the face looking at you like, wait. I know I ain't a saint if it ain't too late. Well, I can't keep on losing you. So fast, no, my heart like gold, but it break like glass. No, my shit get old and I act so young. Baby, you so cold, never had no sun. You don't wanna grow up, you the shit no fun. So when I get home, I'ma give you some, make you feel like wanna